Couple of questions for you to begin tonight. First question, and I expect a response. I want your participation in this. So, how many of you have ever heard a sermon preached from the book of Ecclesiastes? Can I see your hands? All right. How many of you have ever read the entire book of Ecclesiastes? Good. All right. Well, in college, in my modern philosophy course, we had to write our paper for philosophy on the book of Ecclesiastes and going along with modern philosophy. So I had read it before, but it was a very interesting project for us to work through that individually, corporately, in groups, and as a class, and to have our final paper on the book of Ecclesiastes. And tonight, you're going to hear a sermon on Ecclesiastes. The entire book. All of it. I figured since Barrett gave us so much extra time from this morning, I'm going to take that extra time. I get to add that on to tonight. Now, don't be too scared. Just a theme overview of the book and what the main theme is. And there are many passages that we could use to delve into deep study. Really, it talks about the maze of life, the vanity. We all know vanity and vexation. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And we could look at individual things and just get individual sermons out of there. But I wanted to do kind of a dropping in and out, just different passages to talk about the theme of the book and what we need to keep in mind when we read the book of Ecclesiastes. And the title of my message tonight is this: What Good Is Life When the End Is Death? What good is life when the end is death? And my theme statement that I would like you to remember and to think about as we go through this is this: if you do not find the good, and I have the good in quotation marks, in life, then every day of your miserable existence is vanity and vexation. Doesn't that sound like a really, wow, inspiring, right? And the first couple points of my message, I will be honest, are not going to be very inspiring. In fact, probably kind of depressing maybe, but keep hope, because that's the point of this book, is there is hope. We have to find the good in life, and that's what we're talking about tonight. So, looking at Ecclesiastes, we're going to be looking at a lot of different passages and a lot of just different things going back and forth, so I hope your Bibles are warmed up. But the first point I want us to see as we look at Ecclesiastes, keeping in mind that question, what good is life when the end is death, is this. The first point that the preacher of Ecclesiastes, the writer, makes is this, is that all is vanity and vexation because all die from this earth. Chapter 1, verse 4 says this, one generation passeth away and another generation cometh, but the earth abideth forever. Our Father, we thank you for this time to preach your word. I pray now your Holy Spirit would come upon me and use me to clearly speak what you have laid upon my heart. And Father, that it would be the truth of thy word spoken to willing ears, willing to listen, willing to be obedient, and to understand what this book is about. So Father, I pray that in all these things you would be honored and glorified. In Jesus' name, amen. One generation passeth away, and another generation cometh, but the earth abideth forever. What he's trying to say there is that we have seen over all the years since creation that men keep passing away, keep dying generation after generation. The earth that God created at the beginning of all things is still here. But all that lives dies. And so the preacher here is talking about the point, he's trying to make the point throughout this book that the reason there is vanity, that all of this is vanity, the reason all of this looks like vexation is because if we look at it just from a worldly standpoint, forgetting everything spiritual, but we think about just life here on earth, it is vexation, it is a life of vexation, it is a life of vanity, of wastefulness, of nothing matters, nothing counts. In chapter 2, verse 14 and 16, he says this, the wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walketh in darkness. And I myself perceived also that one event happeneth to them all. One event happens to the wise and to the foolish. Verse 16, for there is no remembrance of the wise more of the fool than of the fool forever, seeing that which now is in the days to come shall all be forgotten. And what is that one event that he's talking about? And how dieth the wise man? Just like the fool. We all die the same. We all die. You can be wise, you can be foolish, you're still going to die. We all die. Chapter 3, verse 19 and 20. For that which befalleth the sons of men befalleth beasts. Even one thing befalleth them. As the one dieth, so dieth the other. Yea, they have all one breath. Notice this. So that a man, a human, hath no preeminence above a beast, for all is vanity. For that which befalleth the sons of men befalleth beasts. Even one thing befalleth them. As the one dieth, so dieth the other. Yea, they have all one breath, so that a man hath no preeminence over the beasts. You're no better than an animal. Have you heard that before? Now, unfortunately, our culture today, those who try to say, well, you know, we need to be kind to the animals. We shouldn't be doing all these things that we do to animals. And they have souls, too. And they love to use this passage. And they love to say, you know, the Bible teaches we need to love all things and take care of all things. That's not what the writer is saying. But here he is making the comparison that in death, we're no better than an animal. We all die. That's all he's trying to say. All go into one place, verse 20, all are of the dust, and all turn to dust again. Are you depressed yet? You're no better than an animal. You have a dog? Sorry, you're no better than your dog or your cat. I don't even want to be compared to a cat. But anyway, we're no better than beasts because we die. Chapter 6, verse 6. Yea, though he live, that is a man, live 1,000 years, twice told, 2,000 years even, yet hath he seen no good, do not all go to one place. Chapter 7, verse 2. It is better to go to the house of mourning white than to go to the house of feasting, for that is the end of all men. If you remember that you go to the house of mourning to a funeral home, you're brought with the reality. We all die. So it's better that we remember we all have the same end, and the living will lay it to his heart. In other words, we'll take it to heart. You know what? I'm going to die. Don't know when. I don't know how. But if the Lord tarries, I'm going to die. Chapter 8, verse 8. There is no man that hath power over the spirit to retain the spirit. In other words, what makes us who we are. Neither hath he power in the day of death, and there is no discharge in that war. And you see that that is in italics, that is in italics. So we say, and there is no discharge in war. In other words, the war does not give back its dead. Neither shall wickedness deliver those that are given to it. Be real with yourself. Admit that the end of all living things is death, and no human has the power to prevent or to reverse it. We're all going to die. And chapter 9, verses 1 through 6. For all this I considered in my heart, even to declare all this, that the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of God. No man knoweth either love or hatred by all that is before them. All things come alike to all. There is one event to the righteous and to the wicked, to the good and to the clean and to the unclean, to him that sacrificeth and to him that sacrificeth not. As is the good, so is the sinner, and he that sweareth is he that feareth an oath. There is an evil among all things that are done under the sun, that there is one event unto all. Yea, also the heart of the sons of men is full of evil, and madness is in their heart while they live. And after that, they die. They go to the dead. For to him that is joined to all the living there is hope, for a living dog is better than a dead lion. At least he's alive for a while. For the living know that they shall die. But the dead know not anything, neither have they any more a reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. Also their love, and their hatred, and their envy is now perished. Neither have they any more a portion forever in anything that is done under the sun. So in there he gives us some hope. He says, well, it's good that, you know, a living dog is better than a dead lion. He that is righteous, or the living know that they shall die, but the dead, it's over. When you're dead, you're dead. That's it. As the world sees it, in this life, under the sun. And everything we've done, everything we've been, will be forgotten. That's why it's vanity. It's all vanity. Our lives are all vanity because we all die from this earth. And that leads me to the second question then, or the second point, which is this question. What are we given in life that is vexation and such vanity? What does he tell us in this book? Why do we have vexation? Why is this all vanity? He's told us it's all vanity. It's not worth living. We're going to be forgotten. What's the point? We're all going to die anyway. So what are we given in life that makes this seem like such a vanity and such vexation? Well, the first thing we're given is our labor, our works, our travail. Back to chapter 1, verse 13, says, "And I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. This sore travail hath God given to the sons of man to be exercised therewith." That is, God has given us, we have to work on this earth to survive. And then to chapter 2, verses 4 through 11, he talks about all the things that he, the preacher, had done. "I made me great works, I builded me houses, I planted me vineyards, I made me gardens and orchards, and I planted trees in them of all kinds of fruits. I made me pools of water to water therewith the wood that bringeth forth trees. I got me servants and maidens, and had servants born in my house. Also I had great possessions of great and small cattle above all that were in Jerusalem before me. I gathered me also silver and gold and the peculiar treasure of kings and of the provinces. I got me men singers and women singers and the delights of the sons of men as musical instruments and that of all sorts. So I was great and I increased more than all that were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. And whatsoever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my portion of all my labor." All those things. Now we come to verse 11. "Then I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought, and on the labor that I had labored to do, and behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit, and there was no profit under the sun." Now we have to remember, who are we talking about as the writer of Ecclesiastes? Does anybody know? Solomon, okay? The man who considered the greatest, the wisest man. He had accumulated all these things. We know, we can see the record of everything Solomon did, everything he had, how much wealth was brought into his kingdom under his reign. And here he's saying, "I looked on all of that, everything I'd worked for, everything I had labored, everything I brought into this country, into my kingdom, and behold, it's all vanity and vexation of spirit. It just vexes me. It's all vanity. It's worthless by itself." But he says that's not the only thing that we're given that makes this earth seem so vexing and so vain. We also come back to chapter 1 and verse 17. He says, "I gave my heart to know wisdom." And by doing that, he says, "and to know madness and folly, I perceived that this also is a vexation of spirit." Trying to understand this world and trying to understand the philosophy and the thinking of everybody in mankind is so vexing and it's worthless. And of course, as we studied this in modern philosophy, we learned a lot of worthless men's thoughts in philosophy. But you gain the wisdom, you learn about the knowledge and the wisdom of how life on earth works or how people think life on earth works, what are truths, and it's vain. It's vexing to hear how they argue with each other, to see how it doesn't match, it doesn't seem to make sense. What use is it? What hope does that bring me? Okay, you have this great thought of this philosophy or this thought that you think this is how the world works. What does that do for me? It's vain. And that's what Solomon is saying. It all seems vain. On to chapter 2, verses 12 through 14. "And I turned myself to behold wisdom." Again, he's studying wisdom and madness and folly. "For what can the man do that cometh after the king? Even that which hath already been done. Then I saw that wisdom excelleth folly. As far as light excelleth darkness, it has its good points, because the wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walketh in darkness." But again, brings us back To the first point I made, one event happeneth through them all. He still dies. Wisdom excels folly, yes, but you still die. On to chapter 8, verses 16 through 17. When I applied mine heart to know wisdom, and to see the business that is done upon the earth, to understand how things are done upon the earth, for also there is that neither day nor night seeth sleep with his eyes, then I beheld all the work of God that a man cannot find out the work is done under the sun, because though a man labor to seek it out, in other words, even though someone tries to find and understand the wisdom that this earth offers and how things work, we have science, we have philosophers, they all try to determine what is truth, what is right. Even though we seek it out, yet he shall not find it. Yea, farther, though a wise man think to know it, he thinks he knows it all, yet shall he not be able to find it. Why is it vexation? What are we given in life? It is that limited understanding of things, that we cannot know all things. And that vexes a lot of people. You talk to men who consider them wise, philosophers, and they think they have all the answers, but when it comes to it, they don't. And that vexes them. And they become very upset, very angry, because there are just some things you cannot know. And what's really vexing is what we see back in verse 14 of chapter 8. There is a vanity which is done upon the earth, that there be just men unto whom it happeneth according to the work of the wicked. Again, there be wicked men to whom it happeneth according to the work of the righteous. I said that this also is vanity. And this is something I think we all can understand what he's saying in this verse, and that is, why do bad things happen to good people? And why do good things happen to what seem to be bad people? I know growing up, talking and hearing my parents talk, I can't remember how old I was, but somehow we got onto the topic of George Burns. I don't know how many of you know who George Burns is, but many of you do, I'm sure, and you know how wicked a man he is and how wicked a life he lived. But at this point, it was in the media, it was on TV, how old he was. He was turning this age, and look how long he's lived. And of course, they're doing, how did you live this long? Well, I smoked my cigar, and I lived the way I wanted, and I live a free and happy life. And because I'm free of stress, and I've lived a long life. And I remember Mom and Dad saying, it is horrible that somebody so wicked has been allowed to live so long and do so much damage with his comedy. And that's what Solomon is saying here. Why does it seem that bad things happen to good people and the evil and the wicked don't seem to get what they deserve in this life? It's vexing. Sometimes you think, why do I even try? Why do I even live for the Lord if someone who lives so wickedly and just lives freely and does what they want, they don't seem to have any trouble? And if we focus on that, as the writer here is saying, if that's what we focus on, we're going to come to the conclusion, we're all going to die anyway. Why don't I just live the way I want? It's all vanity. It's all vexation. Why? What good is it? Well, now we have the hope. Our third point is this question. What are we given in life that is good? What does the writer of Ecclesiastes tell us that we are given that is good? Well, before we get into that, we need to remember this one statement. Only a good God can give good things. Only a good God can give good things. Only a good God can help us see the good things and understand the good things. What is it that he gives? We've already seen previously that this writer says he gives us work and labor, and that's our vexation of spirit. But now he seems to balance that out with the first part of this point, and that is he gives us the ability to eat, drink, and be merry, enjoy the fruits of our labor. That's what God gives us that is good. Now, is it those things themselves that are good? No, it's God gives us a good enjoyment of those things as we trust in him. You want to see the proof? Go back to chapter 2 and verse 24. There is nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink and that he should make his soul enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw that it was from the hand of God. Chapter 3, verse 13. And also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. Verse 22. Wherefore I perceive that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his portion. For who shall bring him to see what shall be after him? Chapter 5, verses 18 and 19. Behold, that which I have seen, it is good and comely for one to eat and to drink and to enjoy the good of all his labor that he taketh under the sun all the days of his life, which God giveth him, for it is his portion. Every man also to whom God hath given riches and wealth and hath given him power to eat thereof and to take his portion and to rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. Chapter 8, verse 15. Then I commended mirth, because a man hath no better thing under the sun. Now notice he's saying this is under the sun. So this is our life here on earth. Than to eat and to drink and to be merry, for that shall abide with him of his labor the days of his life, which God giveth him under the sun. And then chapter 9, verses 7 through 10. Go thy way, eat thy bread with joy, and drink thy wine with a merry heart, for God now accepteth thy works. Let thy garments be always white, and let thy head lack no ointment. Live joyfully with the wife whom thou lovest all the days of thy life of thy vanity, which he hath given thee under the sun, all the days of thy vanity. For that is thy portion in this life, and in thy labor which thou takest under the sun. And whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with thy might. For there is no work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in the grave whither thou goest. So he refers back to the fact that you're still going to die. So enjoy your life while you have it. And here's where we have to be very careful. Because this is where the Epicureans went wrong. Epicurean thought is eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you may die. And that's the philosophy of a lot of people in society today. Eat, drink, and be merry. He who dies with the most toys wins. He who has the biggest toys, you know, whatever it is. That's the thought. And many of them will say, well, you know, look, in Ecclesiastes it says, enjoy it while you can because you're going to die, so you might as well enjoy your life. God gives it to you. That's not what he's saying. We have to take it in the full context, and that's what I'm trying to do tonight, is give you the full context of the book of Ecclesiastes. He's showing us the hopelessness of living a life only focused on what we have here on earth, thinking as man thinks. That's hopeless. That's vanity. That's vexation. But we can find good things in our life here on earth. Because of what God gives us, the fact that he gives us the ability to enjoy eating. I know a lot of us enjoy eating. That's proved at church fellowships. All right? We like to eat. We like to drink and be merry. Who gives us the ability to find joy in our fellowship as Christian brothers and sisters? Where does that joy come from? From God. I have to be honest. I go to work after a church fellowship dinner, and they say, oh, what'd you do this weekend? Oh, it's great. We had this church fellowship dinner. You know, we ate fried chicken and mashed potatoes. And what'd you do this weekend? Oh, I got drunk. And okay, I don't remember half the weekend. Well, at least I remember my joy. I remember, you know, sitting down and talking to Barak and Jesse and being entertained at the table, you know? All these things. We can have stories about, you know, it was so good to talk to so-and-so at the fellowship this week. And to hear stories and hear how the Lord's working, that's because of God's goodness. And God gives us the ability to enjoy that. He gives us the goodness of enjoying the fruits of our labor. Growing up, my parents taught me, enjoy your hard work. The joy of hard work is seeing a project finished. You step back, you look at it, and you just, that is a job well done. That looks good. Now, as a young child, unfortunately, it was more like, Dad, help. And then Dad would teach me, now, son, you need to measure twice and cut once. Don't cut twice. Right? the right way to do it. Mom taught me how to wrap a broken limb or a sprained ankle correctly so that you give the best support. All these things, is you look at it and you think, that is a job well done. I can feel satisfied. That's what I wanted to do. That's what I wanted to accomplish. Now, the main job Dad taught me was we did mowing lawns, did yard work, tilling yards, snow removal. So for me, it was, with my father, getting done with mowing a lawn or in the middle of winter, clearing a driveway and sidewalks, and you get back in the truck, and I just vividly remember this. I always got in the truck, and then I'd look out the window at what we'd just done. Wow. That looks good. Not for pride reason, just that was good work. We got that done. We earned the money that we got paid today, especially when the snow drifts were 6 feet high. But we don't do those things. We don't eat, drink, and be merry, and labor, and do things to please ourselves in and of them just for the end of doing that. God gives us the ability to enjoy that, to find the good, and to find true joy in those things because of how we find the good. And that leads me to my fourth point. How do we find the good in life to overcome all this vanity, all this thought of vexation that he's been talking about through this book? Well, first, we have to be careful to listen in fear or in awe of God rather than to speak rashly before a holy God. That is in chapter 5, verses 1 through 7. Here is the passage, and you may be very familiar with this, where it says, be careful what you vow before God. It says, keep thy foot when thou goest to the house of God, and be more ready to hear than to give the sacrifice of fools, and that is just to speak out, for they consider not that they do evil. Be not rash with thy mouth, and let not thine heart be hasty to utter anything before God, for God is in heaven, and thou upon earth. Therefore, let thy words be few. And he goes on to say, when thou vowest a vow unto God, defer not to pay it. In other words, be very careful with what you say, with what you vow in the presence of God. Verse 6, suffer not thy mouth to cause thy flesh to sin. We have to be careful with what we say. And in verse 7, he ends with this. In all of this, fear thou God. Listen. Don't be so quick to speak. Listen to what God has to say. And God will show you the good. And in doing so, you will gain profitable wisdom. Go to chapter 7, verses 11 and 12 with me, please. Wisdom is good with an inheritance. And by it there is profit to them that see the sun. For wisdom is a defense, and money is a defense, but the excellency of knowledge is that wisdom giveth life to them that have it. Now, didn't he just finish saying that the wise and the fool both die? And that this was vexation, this was vanity, they both die. But now he's saying, wisdom is good with an inheritance. Wisdom is a defense. The excellency of knowledge is that wisdom giveth life to them that have it. But that's followed up by what in verse 13? How do we do that? Consider the work that you've done? No. Consider the work that your family has accomplished? No. Consider the work of God. For who can make that straight which he hath made crooked? Consider who holds all the power. Who holds all the authority over this creation that we're talking about? It is God. Your excellency of knowledge, your wisdom that is profitable, comes from the wisdom of knowing who God is. So we need to be careful to listen in fear of God, but we also need to be careful to act in fear of God. And this is in chapter 12, as we come to the end of the book. Chapter 12, the last two verses, and this is where he literally sums up what he has been trying to accomplish and say in this entire book. Verse 13, let us hear the conclusion, the summation of everything I've been saying. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. What is it? Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. Fear God and keep his commandments. Do what you know the creator of the universe, the creator of this world, this earth, this life, the one who gives us the very breath we have, fear him and obey his commandments. This is your duty. Fear God, love God, be obedient to God. But he doesn't leave it there. He says, why? For God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. We need to be careful to act in the fear of God, because even as God gives us these joys, the ability to joy in our labor, to enjoy what we eat, to enjoy what we drink, to find the good in life through him, that same God also judges our good and our evil. All throughout this book, he says it's vanity as vexation, because it doesn't matter whether you do good or evil, you're all going to die. So what worth is it? What good is it? Right here, God's going to judge it. He talks about through this book how that you're not going to be remembered. The things you do, whether they're good or bad, nobody's going to remember that after a few years. It's going to be forgotten. So why worry about it? Because God judges. And God not just judges what is known, but notice in the middle of that verse, with every secret thing. Every secret thought you've had when you're by yourself. Maybe you're not by yourself. Maybe you're in a group and someone says something or someone does something and you have that thought come across your head. You don't say it, but you think it. It's in your heart. God's going to judge it. Be careful to act in the fear of God. When you do that, you obey the commandments of God. You know what God requires. That's where you find the good and the joy. Because you know what is bad. You say, no, okay, I stay away from that. And God increases your wisdom, increases your knowledge, and you see the good in life. And you find the good and the joy that he wants to give you as his creation. Without the joy, the wisdom, and the knowledge of the good in this world, through God, the creator of it all, the life in this world that we have, all this life has to offer, is vanity and vexation. It is no wonder that a world increasingly bent on removing God and forgetting God in every aspect of life is so hopeless, so joyless, and so much without peace. And I'm sure you see that. Friends and family who are unsaved, co-workers. Oh, sure, they say, oh, yeah, I had a good time this weekend. And, you know, they're striving always to have a good time and to find happiness. But you get down to the heart of it. And many of you can give testimony how you tried to find happiness and you tried all the things this world had to offer and you couldn't find joy and peace until you found God. But no wonder we live in a society and a world today that is so hopeless and so joyless. The writer even goes on to state in a couple of places, we'll just look at these last two passages, Ecclesiastes chapter 4 and verse 3. Yea, better is he, in other words, one who's dead, or says, let's go back to verse 2. Wherefore I praise the dead which are already dead more than the living which are yet alive. Yea, better is he than both they which hath not yet been, who hath not seen the evil work that is done under the sun. Now, that's just King James for saying it was better you just weren't even born. Okay? Chapter 6, verse 3. If a man beget 100 children and live many years, so that the days of his years be many, and his soul be not filled with good, and also that he have no burial, I say that an untimely birth is better than he. In other words, you didn't make it out of the womb. that person has it better. If all they had to look forward in life was vexation and vanity of life with never knowing God and knowing the good that God can show them, it's better they were never born. Pretty serious thought. But that's what Solomon is telling us. How worthless this life on earth is, except for the enlightenment and the wisdom and knowledge of good that God gives us. May we find the good in life through the one who created it, gives it, and rewards it.